A Letter from Gallipoli, 20th of April, 1915.
During both the First and Second World Wars, a program to support alumni, staff and students on active duty was in place at the State Teacher Training College and its various successes. Letters were sent out and many service personnel responded by writing to the principal or simply to college. One response was written by William Hoggett to the principal of the college, Dr. John Smythe. This letter is included in the collection of the Melbourne College of Advanced Education, held at the University of Melbourne Archives. Parts of Hoggett's letter were read aloud at Anzac Day commemorations of the college for many years. Today, the letter is read in its entirety by Matthew Williams. William Ross Hoggett of Middle Brighton enlisted in the AIF in September 1914 at the age of 38. As a teacher at Melbourne Grammar School, he had been an officer in the Victorian Cadet Corps and so was assigned the rank of captain in the 14th Battalion, commanded by Colonel John Monash. The 14th Battalion embarked for duty overseas in December 1914 and after a brief stop in Western Australia, arrived in Egypt at the end of January. The battalion became part of the New Zealand and Australian Division that landed at Anzac Cove on the afternoon of the 25th of April 1915. In the first part of the letter, written as his transport ship lay off the Dardanelles, Hoggett describes life on board, telling a story or two about the multinational crew, especially his young Ceylonese cabin boy who had previously served with one of the great boxers of the day.
Dear Doctor, we are lying in a harbour almost within sound of the enemy's guns, and yet you Melbourne folks know far more of the war than we. Most of our news is gleaned from month-old Australian papers. Our regiment of 1,000 fighting men, physically as good as anything at the front, is in splendid spirits, all ready for the business ahead. We are thoroughly equipped and have served out ammunition, iron rations and field dressings. I do not suppose that we will do anything very great, and trust that we will do nothing mean. A stranger in the transport would not think we are on the brink of active service. The talk in the officers' mess is more of what we will do after the war, when we return to Australia. Everyone nourishes the pathetic fallacy that he will come through all right. This cheerfulness is not confined to us. The men, too, are in high spirits. As I write, a full-throated chorus of the national anthem rings out. It is the ending of a complimentary concert tendered to our own regiment by the men of a New Zealand battalion, whose transport is lashed to ours. I spent the afternoon reading Scott's Pirate, and listening to my diminutive Cingalee cabin boy, who unfolded a wondrous tale of how he had knocked out a certain Chinaman who lives in the dim recesses of the forecastle. This Homeric conflict was gone through in pantomime, from the preliminary sparring for an opening until the delivery of the final deadly uppercut. This fiery Cingalee further informed me that he had at one time been body servant to no less a person than Jack Johnson. Hence his pugilistic prowess. I take his word for it, and furthermore forgive him for much prior neglect of his cabin duties. I now know why the cistern that supplies my washbowl was often empty, whereas the tin that receives the wastewaters thereof was invariably overflowing. How could a man who had waited on the mighty Jack Johnson be expected to fill the one or remove the other? Our ship is worked entirely by boys of various colours, Lascars, Japanese, Cingalese, Chinese, Madrasese. The ship's doctor is a Parsi, and two of the mates are Japs. The black chief steward is obsessed with the number 10. At every meal, the menu card shows 10 courses, no more, no less. We live simply, so he is hard put to it to fill the bill. He starts off boldly with soup, and then we have 2, steak, 3, onions, 4, potatoes, 5. Cabbage. 6. Marmalade. 7. Bread and butter. And just when you think that you have him beaten, he calls up his reserves and rounds off the list with 8. Dessert. 9. Fruits. And 10. Coffee. These three items invariably end every meal. The dessert does not always materialise, and the coffee is often condensed water.
Approximately 100,000 Australians spent some time in British-controlled Egypt during the First World War. Many, like William Hoggart, underwent basic training in Egypt before deployment to other theatres of action.
You will have heard a good deal about our work in Egypt. At times we worked very hard, but we also had our glad days and jolly days. The most interesting part of the training was the divisional work. This means the turning out of something like 20,000 men and 10,000 horses. You will understand that a division can concentrate and display only once in a day. We generally had one day a week of this training, and it was the most valuable of all. These manoeuvres were made as realistic as possible. We did several attacks with ball cartridge, the objective being dummy figures placed in trenches. In one of these, we advanced under cover of shrapnel fire. The premature burst wounded a light horseman, but not seriously. We also did some night work against trenches protected by wire entanglements. The only way to deal with barbed wire seems to be to throw it into the sea. If you cut it, it is still there. If you send out adventurous spirits with grappling irons, they haul it up by the roots, only to dump it elsewhere. Though our Aachen is cut off, the accursed thing remains. I would like those people in Australia who call us 6-shilling-a-day tourists to see the regiment slogging home through the sand after a field day. The men in marching order, with their faces greeny-grey from the cake dust. They perhaps have tramped 20 miles through the sand and have been bucketed about in an attack over the desert hills, and all they get for lunch is a scanty ration of bread and jam. Contrast them with the immaculate young men who in summer camp around the foreshore of Port Phillip and who send group photographs of themselves to the illustrated papers, crossed Union Jacks in the background, under the titles of the lilies, the daffodils or the slipstones. The climate of Egypt greatly surprised us when we arrived in February. The days were warm, but the nights intensely cold. Minor poets and lady novelists write of the burning plains of Egypt. Try them on the outpost line at 3 a.m.
Nearly 16,000 photographs taken by Australian soldiers in Egypt are included in the collections at the Australian War Memorial. Many more are in other public collections and family albums. William Hoggart saw not only the pyramids, temples and tombs, he was a keen observer of the local people and ways of life very different from those he knew in Melbourne.
I have had a grand chance of seeing this wonderful old country and have found it a land of contrasts. I do not know whether you have been in Egypt or not. You find the intensest of culture and absolute desert. Electric trams passing through fields painfully cultivated and watered by means of instruments which you see carved in the hieroglyphs of the temples. A climate which seesaws between a grill and a refrigerator. The 4,000-year-old tombs lit by electric light. Magnificent mosques rising from amongst squalid hutches. Motor cars jostling camel trains. Marconi stations near the site of the ancient city of Om. An Australian army camped at Heliopolis. You could multiply these examples easily. I have seen some 500 miles of the Nile Valley. It is one huge market garden and farmyard. In and around Cairo, I have found time to visit the pyramids, the wonderful tombs of Saqqara, the Ali Muhammad Mosque, the Tomb of the Mamelukes, the Roman Aqueduct, the Great Delta Irrigation Works. A party of us spent 2 glorious days at Luxor, where we saw the great temples of Karnak, Luxor and Amon-Ra, the Avenue of Sphinxes, the Colossi at Thebes, and greatest of all, the tombs of the ancient kings. If you have been there, you will know what a wonderland lies around Luxor. The tomb of Amenophis II impressed me most of all. The paintings and hieroglyphics on the walls of the passages leading to the tomb chamber are as fresh as if painted yesterday. The sarcophagus has been covered with a sheet of glass and the mummy unswathed. The old king lies as if carved from ebony, every feature and limb perfect. It is difficult to believe that he lived 1,000 years before Socrates. In a niche nearby lie the bodies of his three favourite slaves, and another niche was carved for his treasure chest. Why can't we leave these old pharaohs undisturbed? A phrase of Charles Lamb's about meddlesome trouble tombs was at the back of my head all day. I have some admiration for the fellaheen who toil on their few feddans of land aided by the family buffalo, family camel and the family donkey, but his city-bred brother is poor stuff. If he is wealthy, he runs to fancy socks and loud suits and infests the city gardens. As far as superficial acquaintance with the situation here can be relied on, there seems little chance of a rising against British rule. The Muslim section may be against us, but they have no method of organising or of obtaining munitions of war. It is impossible to buy rifles or cartridges in Cairo. The Jippi army has been sent away down to Khartoum, except for a few squadrons of cavalry and a few companies of infantry, while their barracks are occupied by territorials and Indian troops. If it were allowed to quote figures, the number of troops in Egypt and along the canal would surprise you.
Hoggett closes his letter with a few remarks about home. War strengthened the connections between members of the teaching community so that Hoggett had no hesitation in asking for support for his wife Rebecca. He also refers to propaganda regarding the Turks as he prepares for battle. Many references in this letter are not immediately understood by a 21st century audience, so a footnoted transcription is available from the archive's website.
I wish I were able to tell you something of what is going on around us. We form part of a force of mixed nationalities which is under the control of an English general of repute. If the expedition is successful, the result should be historic, and I for one will feel proud of having played a very small part in cancelling an event which happened in 1453. I read your Christmas circular letter with pleasure, and appreciate to the full the references you made concerning those members of college who are with the AIF. Give my best wishes to Mrs. Smith, and tell her that I would be glad if she would call on Mrs. Hoggett, who will have an anxious time from now on. The address is 164 St. Kilda Street, Middle Brighton. Yours sincerely, William R. Hoggett.
William Hoggett was killed in action just a few days after writing this letter. According to his service record, he was buried on Queen's Hill, but the exact location of his grave is unknown. His personal effects and kit bag were sent to his wife Rebecca and two daughters, Jean and Marjorie. The bodies of Australian soldiers were not repatriated. In 1921, Rebecca Hoggett received a copy of the Education Department's Record of War Service, which was distributed free to every government school and teacher soldier or their next of kin. It described the department's wartime activities and contained brief biographies of the 769 teacher soldiers who served on active duty. The University of Melbourne published a similar war record and included an entry for alumnus William Hoggett.